Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. For the people often say when you say, "Wow, what was that panel?" It's like herding cats. Just the last 3 minutes was exactly like herding cats. Rich wouldn't go in the room alone for some reason. He kept on straying, was feral.
Rosemary
to continue.
He didn't want to be the only one in here,
he
which is understandable.
That everybody had to hug and everything. And well, we're here and we're ready and all's good and we can finally start the show. Good morning. Welcome. It is Wednesday, I believe. It's the 26th of June, and very nice to have you with us today. Let me introduce our panel to you, and then we'll get started. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A lot going on in the news. We'll get to as much of it as we possibly can. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good
How
morning.
Are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Good to have you here. Also, you know Rich Honan, corporate attorney, our good friend.
Can't wait to have a go.
I know. Yes. I know.
He's got some bad ideas.
Rich,
she already one-upped me by taking. I took my chair. I'm a little off balance.
Rich wrote earlier in the week, and I said, "You know, Rosemary's back," and he said, "Yeah." And said, "I said, you want to go a couple of rounds?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm good."
What I said was, "It would be nice to see Rosemary again."
Oh,
that is very true. That is very, very true. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill is here. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Good.
Very nice to have you with us. Jen Smith, Berkshire Eagle reporter extraordinaire. Good morning, Jen. How are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
I'm fine. You know, it's sort of like post-election, a lot of beehive of activity and watching the returns come in last night. So that was fun. And, Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
Yo.
Excellent. How are you? Anything else you want to add other than that? That's it. Fine if you say no.
Yo.
All right. Yo squared. All right. Let us go and talk about what's happening in the world. And a lot going on. Chris, I'm going to start off with you. This isn't even on our docket today, but I just want to ask you, what do you make of the Cohoes mayor's race?
I was a little bit surprised. I thought Sean Morris, I thought it would be a little bit closer than it turned out to be. I don't remember the numbers exactly, but I think something like 75% of voters in Cohoes voted against Sean Morris, who's the embattled. That's the adjective that always follows or precedes his name.
Yes.
The embattled mayor there. And I was surprised. I thought he was a little bit more popular than that.
Well, indicted, right?
Indicted, yes.
Indicted.
Accused.
Accused. Goes on trial in July. Was up against three competitors. And
also accused of domestic
violence. Right. Yeah. No charges filed in those cases,
right,
however.
Right.
So, Alan, what do you make of that with the dust settled now?
Well, you know, it's funny. You really can't fool all the people all the time. I mean, you know, when you get all of those charges put together and still the guy gets a lot of votes, it's always interesting that people will stick with their guy, even some people will, and others will say, okay, we've had enough.
Yeah, and
is that a brilliant analysis?
I think so.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think it's true, certainly.
I mean, I think a lot of people were tired of seeing Cohoes kind of, you know, I think a lot of people are embarrassed by the whole situation and thought that it reflected really poorly on the city. And I think, you know, even some people who like Sean Morris probably voted against him just because they kind of wanted this cloud out from over City Hall.
I'm hoping a lot of Americans will be thinking like that soon.
Rosemary, when you...
Sean has been called the Trump of Cohoes. Yeah.
So, Rosemary, what do you think most people, when they hear the word Cohoes, if they're out in Massachusetts or Connecticut, what is the first thing they think of?
The Cohoes Falls, I'm sure.
Cohoes Falls, the Mastodon, what else?
The Mastodon.
No, I think the Trumpeter Swan, which says, Cohoe.
I think
getting so much of an education.
It's long out of there. The Cohoes Coat Factory, that was imbibed into so many of us. Do you young people don't even remember that? Huh?
No, they're
no. I remember. I think it was still open when I first got here.
Yeah,
but it has been a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
All right, let's go to other stuff then, and we'll talk with about the yesterday we spent a lot of time talking about the migrant children moved out of this facility in Texas outside of El Paso, and then yesterday we learned that 100 of the children were actually returned to that troubled Texas border facility. In Clint, Texas. That's because there was really no other place to put them. At the sand-colored concrete border station in Texas that has become the center of a debate over President Trump's immigration policies, a chaotic shuffle of migrant children continued Tuesday as more than 100 were moved back into a facility that days earlier had been emptied in the midst of criticism that young detainees were hungry, crying, and unwashed. The transfer came just days after 249 children originally housed at the station in Clint, Texas, had been moved to other facilities to relieve overcrowding. The continuing movement of children and confusion over housing of the Border Patrol's youngest detainees pointed to an increasingly disorganized situation along the southern border and an agency struggling to maintain minimal humanitarian standards amid an unprecedented influx of migrant families. State Representative Terry Canales of Texas, a Democrat, says we've dipped far below the standard of care into the realms of just utter darkness. We're in a dark place as a nation, and it just breaks my heart. In Clint, a farm town about 20 miles southwest of El Paso with fewer than 1,000 residents, there was consternation and dismay among residents at reports from lawyers who visited the border station recently, who said they found children as young as 5 months old that had been housed with filthy clothes, dirty diapers, and inadequate food.
You move.
Go ahead, Alan.
Joe, am I the only one who thinks that each of these decisions that have been made, putting those 100 people back, comes from the Oval Office? I mean, is it the lawyers and making cogent arguments, or is it the president who hears this stuff and says, "I look bad in this. We gotta recoup some of the ground." You think that's too cynical?
Well, I don't know. What the one question I have, and I don't know, and hopefully someone on the panel knows the answer to this. I looked it up, but only briefly, which was when they took too many and 50 children out of the facility. Did they leave any there?
Don't know the answer to that.
And
they
so
didn't have enough space, I thought.
Yeah. So I thought it was to relieve overcrowding. Yeah. So I didn't know if they were leaving children there, in which case when you put 100 back, you are then still 100 up from what you normally would be or where you should be. That was my question.
Yeah.
Okay, we have to find
it's so
out.
So hard to run concentration camps efficiently, you know?
But to Alan's point, if you're the White House and you have this issue, you've moved the children, then you can't find places for them. Ultimately, it's that his decision to say, okay, we'll send them back to the other facility, and we'll go from there.
I doubt that.
Well, that's almost rational, right? That wasn't what I meant. I meant the president turns on the television.
It's intentional, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I don't really know, because I think this is not a new problem. It's something that's been, you know, plaguing facilities for a long time since this process has been happening. And again, nothing's been done about it, and it only seems to be getting worse.
Well, that's Trump's line. Oh, it's much worse under Obama. Oh, that's your line too, Rich.
Opening salvo. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, obviously everybody is now starting to agree with what President Trump's been saying for the last year and a half, which is this is truly a crisis. It was heading towards crisis proportions. Nobody likes what's going on. I think both, we'll probably talk about some of the legislation, but I think both houses have approved in some way some method of getting, you know, billions of dollars to help relieve some of these issues, but they're still fighting over other parts of it. But it's I don't know how it could be any more clear that it is a crisis. It's been a crisis.
National emergency?
I would say so. Now, I know as early as January of this year, Pelosi and Schumer were doing their side-by-side conference, saying it's not a conference, it's not a crisis, it's fault, it's made up. And as recently as Memorial Day, there was a chance to pass legislation on this. And now, unfortunately, everybody now realizes this is where we are.
You are so full of beans. And I'm going to tell you, this guy has created this crisis. Yep. It started. It was what it always had been. It's much, much worse than when he started it. He tested it. He almost invited it. And to say that this is clear now that we've been in this crisis is nonsense. This guy made this crisis.
Alan, I hate to let the facts destroy a good narrative that you have, but if you remember, in the beginning of the Trump administration, illegal immigration was down on the order of 40% to 50%, and based mainly upon him using the bully pulpit, saying we don't want illegal immigrants coming in this manner. And then there was a series of court decisions that overturned executive decisions. There was these caravans that appear to be largely financed by these FCOs, which nobody seems to be investigating.
What is an FCO?
Foreign criminal organization.
Right? Muslim groups are sending in.
No, I think that's the phrase, and maybe I have the acronym wrong, but I think that's what they use in Homeland Security. They're talking about mainly drug cartels that are pushing a lot of these caravans. So, Alan, it is worse now, but it is worse because of judicial interference,
and it's worse because of
congressional unwillingness on both sides to do anything helpful.
And I say you have created your own anti-argument, and here's what happened. You said in the beginning, he used the bully pulpit, it was down. Then all of a sudden, it got worse. It got worse because what, Rich? Because this guy had decided this was the one thing that was going to carry him to re-election. And he has not let up on it for a single second. And you know what? I think in some ways he's delighted that he has created this monster and that he can then point to it as being what you have just said.
I don't think I agree with that, Alan. I mean, I think that what we're seeing, he campaigned on ending chaos at the border and on curbing immigration into the country, illegal immigration into the country. And what's happened is the exact opposite. I mean, everything that he said he was going to do, we have this flood of people. And it may not be entirely his fault. It may be somewhat the result of court decisions and other factors, but that doesn't change the fact that it's gotten a lot worse under his watch. And, you know, some of the steps that he's proposed, such as cutting aid to these countries, is only exacerbating the problem.
That's what I'm thinking. That's exactly right.
And I also think, the way I see it, it's sort of a missed opportunity for the U.S. to become a leader in how to deal with it, because we're not, you know, no one is immune to migration issues right now in the world. There are plenty of areas beyond the U.S. That have for a long time been dealing with people displaced for various reasons, whether it's persecution, whether it's violence, whether it's poor working conditions, whether it's, other human rights issues, and places are becoming overcrowded. So it's if you step away from the politics of it and just look at it as an issue that everyone's dealing with it, why does not the U.S. Step up and say, like, okay, we can actually work and create a management plan to say, if this is happening, how do we deal with this across the table?
Congress needs to appropriate a lot more money. I mean, the conditions that are happening that are reported at this particular camp, I mean, they're atrocious. It shouldn't be happening.
Well,
Alan seems to be suggesting that it's pure malice that is I think it's more incompetence and lack of resources.
Well, it's,
and I think that we should fund better conditions immediately.
Wait a second.
Are you guys sure? Are you absolutely sure that is the case, that he is not doing this in order because it seems so obvious to me that Trump has done this, and that if you appropriated the money, Chris, that he would sign off on that? Nah, he wants those conditions.
I think he's indifferent to it. I don't think he's appropriating. Yeah. I would like to say that I also blame Obama. The deportations were much higher under Obama than under Trump, so he's no hero. Our Congress is just a joke, both parties. They have definitely sidestepped the whole immigration thing. So there are no heroes in this. Well, but Trump is running his reelection campaign based on this. He's created a false false narrative lacking in facts, starting with the word caravan. There are no caravans invading the United States. And we are, yeah, it's true. And the stuff happening on in these concentration camps, that's absolutely fixable. We have the money right now. There is no lack of resources to take care of 5,000 children.
Rosemary, I don't agree. There's 140,000 people coming across a month.
But that's not how many are in these camps.
No, that's true. But it is.
How many 5-month-old babies are sleeping on concrete floors? Let's start with them. We don't have the resources to get them off the concrete floors.
No,
and the House has appropriated that money, Rosemary. That's the point. The House wants it. The Senate won't let it happen because the Senate is, as always, in the pockets of Trump.
That's definitely the issue, but I also think it's much more a systemic issue, too. You know, Homeland Security, they're not child development experts. They're not primary caregivers. No one is trained to actually
Oh, my God. You don't have to be an expert to give kids toothbrushes and soap.
Well, yeah, but so that's still a Band-Aid for the issues at hand, too.
I'll start with that, Jen. We have a mess.
Yeah, but you just said there wasn't a crisis, and I think there is. This is part of the crisis.
I think there is a lack of resources, and I think there is a lot of incompetence. I don't think there's any question about either one of those.
Tell me to put $4 or $5 billion into resources for care of people seeking asylum rather than a border wall.
Well, I think that if you believe the newspapers, there's agreement. There's certainly agreement in the House, and there appears to be agreement in the Senate on the broad strokes of that $4.5 billion aid package. I think, and I'll be honest, usually when I'm on and we're talking about legislation, I try and actually read the bill. But since I think neither of these bills is going to go anywhere in their current form, I didn't read both bills. But what is
How
reported?
Dare you.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
so sloppy.
But. What has been reported is that the Senate version, while it appropriates the money, contains less restrictions on using portions of it for border enforcement or what you do with it, whereas the House version, and as it has been reported, is really more targeted just to this
and not
towards border enforcement. So it sounds like they're kind of 90% there on a lot of this. But Rosemary, and I know Alan thinks that everything this all has to be done with evil intent. I don't really think anybody's real happy. I don't think anybody's real happy
all
about
right, we gotta take a break.
Seeing
back
people
back.
Like this. And I think when you take any problem and you multiply
we'll
it by a million a
right
month.
Back after this.
There we go.
Welcome back to the roundtable. Let's see. We have 11 letters, and Rich is in the subject heading of 6 of them. Okay, let's go.
I'm surprised.
You ready, buddy? Okay, here we go. Dennis says, 2 questions. Alan, while Trump has exacerbated the crisis, you seem to be saying he is responsible for the increased number of illegal crossings. How so?
That's correct. That's correct. He's invited it. He wants it. Obviously, this is his ticket, he thinks, to re-election. And basically, he has indicated that they are in that they are this mass that's coming over the border. He's literally invited it to happen, and when it hasn't worked out that he could stop it, he has created the monster.
Then Dennis asked this question in the same email to Rich. While you are right in that Trump has been saying that there was a crisis for a long time, his original crisis was marauding hordes invading violently. Isn't it disingenuous to pretend he was talking about the welfare of those people?
I know what he was talking about originally, but I think it's not disingenuous to say it was a crisis, it was foreseen, it had probably already reached crisis proportions well before this month, and it was something that the whole problem is we have a system that is overburdened and we don't have an effective statutory or regulatory framework, and I don't think there's anybody who disagrees on that. Unless there's people just think we should just have fully open borders, and I think that's a minority view.
But isn't part of the problem the conditions in those countries? And if you make the conditions in those countries worse, you are exacerbating the problem.
It is, except that Chris, when I was in law school, there was a thing that people that judges write where they say that argument proves too much, and I never really understood what they meant, and I now realize what they're talking about is you could use that. If you use that argument and you take the position that, people are always going to want to go to a better place, you know, in my view, and in lots of people's view, the United States is always going to be a better place.
It is.
And I agree that we should not be cutting them off at the knees by withdrawing funds. But I don't disagree with the idea of tempering some of those funds on them trying to work with us in trying to stem this tide.
See, immigration to me is a little bit of a push-pull. There's always going to be the pull of the United States and the lifestyle and the what we have here. But there's also the push. And if your country is falling apart, you're pushed harder than you are if it's not falling apart. And I think that by cutting aid, we are really exacerbating the problem.
I don't disagree. You know, Trump has had, and I know you guys never call anything he does a policy, but his policy has always been that to the extent that we're going to use influence or to the extent that we're going to spend money anywhere, he wants to use that to get something back for it. And if politically what we're looking for is some help, like what he did with Mexico, you know, threatening the tariffs and then Mexico helped on their southern border.
Oh, yeah, that was brilliant.
And it worked. It empirically worked.
We do not know that the deal was underway. There's
we absolutely know that for a fact
that.
Because the verifiable numbers
Rosemary,
have gone
the
down.
Numbers are down a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean it's not
first
I wouldn't call
month,
it a smashing
a trend.
I wouldn't call it a smashing success, but I would, the numbers are down
right.
a little bit.
But you're right, it's a push pull. There's and Jen's right. There's so many factors, you know, and some of these factors are so societal that I don't know we're ever going to be able to fix them.
Right. I'm not saying we can fix all the problems in these countries or that we should even attempt to, but I just think at this particular moment is not the moment to cut aid when you know that a economic and economic crisis is fueling this push pull. Well, then why make it worse?
I would agree with that if, for example, you had people leaving Honduras and Guatemala and Venezuela and stopping, say, at Mexico, okay, you know, where we do give large amounts of aid, okay? But it seems like a lot of these people, their goal is to get to the United States. And so what it seems to me that you can give as much – look, we can give as much aid as we want to the Venezuelans of the world, and that's not going to help. But having said that, I agree with you.
Well, Mexico's already – as another third-world country. I mean, if you're going to leave your home, which is an incredibly traumatic and difficult thing to do, why stop at another third world country where your conditions aren't going to be? Of course you're going to keep going.
Yeah, and people are always going to want a better life, and everybody should have one. And I agree with you that it would be great if we could use our resources to make every other country a lot better so that people, you know, wouldn't feel this need. I just don't know that I don't know that we realistically can do that.
All right, let me get to some more letters here. We go to Polly, who says Trump only thinks the situation at the border is dire because it reflects badly on him. The comfort of those children is not even on his or Stephen Miller's radars. They are both compassionless racists. Tom says everything happened before. When the Third Army liberated concentration camps in Europe several times, the prisoners had to be returned to the death camps because there was nowhere to put them. Bob writes, let's be clear, separating and caging children in horrendous conditions is not a result of a failed immigration policy. It's a feature designed to send a message to poor brown people, America is not open to you. Jean writes, these children were separated from the caregivers that brought them to this country. They were deliberately separated. Most, if not all, have relatives waiting for them in this country. This was confirmed by attorneys who visited the camps. This family separation was outlawed some time ago. Why is it still happening? Maureen writes to Rich's narrative, if we did not detain these migrants, there would be no crisis. The U.S. is an embarrassment, period.
Is the idea that people were just supposed to not have borders and allow people to come in an unregulated way? I'm not aware of any other.
They're seeking asylum, and that is allowed.
That is allowed, but the system is overburdened. I mean, we all.
Yeah, we're full. Come on.
Jordan,
I just spent 2 years in Jordan, which is a country that has none of the resources of the United States, and it's inundated by refugees from Syria and Iraq. War zones.
Right.
War zones. And they don't have these problems. They don't have kids in detention centers that are under horrible conditions. They process. America has been processing immigrants for 200 years.
But the numbers are so different, Rosemary.
And that's where I'm talking about systemic issues, too. There's still delays upon delays. I've been interviewing a person right now who's going through the legal channels to get citizenship, and it's been way overdue, even though, you know, she and her family have been living in the U.S. for a long time. So there are a lot of systemic issues. Even in the fact, if you go to the borders and you have people who are standing outside of these gates that want to donate diapers, that want to donate toothpaste and things like that, but the bureaucracy says, and this is, again, a global issue where bureaucracy says, no, we can't accept those donations. No, we don't have the methods to distribute aid. You know, those are big systemic problems.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear the system is overburdened. I don't know how anybody could argue that it's not. I mean, there's a backlog of 900,000 asylum cases. Mm-hmm. Now, why that's the case, I mean, it would seem that if you know that the system is overburdened, you fund the system so that it can begin to handle what's coming its way.
But don't you also, I agree with that, but don't you also take some steps to reduce the overburdening? I mean, if all we're going to do is continue funding, you know, funding this overburdened system without taking any steps to try and funnel it down
somehow.
That's
difficult to do with asylum rules because it's international law in part, you know. I mean, it's difficult. I agree with you.
Right, but people are abusing, and the people are abusing the asylum rules. There's millions of people who actually need, you know, who actually need asylum. You'd be silly not to take advantage of the disorganization that we have on the southern border and use that as an excuse to try to get in. So you're hurting the people who actually need asylum, at the same time hurting the people who have actually, you know, come across illegally.
All right, two more letters. One is from Rita, who says Trump has been talking to the liberal media, interviews with Chuck Todd and George Stephanopoulos, in which Trump was so well behaved. I believe that Trump is reaching out to moderates and liberals and that the liberal press are being charmed and flattered by him. Isn't this a big deal?
Isn't
immigration
a big deal? I
don't see any evidence of that at all.
Me neither. And Chris Churchill is the right guy to be asking about this because, as you know, he's a sort of on-the-line columnist. He speaks from, you know, from
out of both sides of his mouth.
I didn't say that.
From both a
conservative and a more liberal perspective. So I'd be interested in what he thought of whether the American people have been charmed by this offensive by
he said the media wasn't charmed.
Yeah,
I don't see any evidence.
And
the media just gets criticized. If they weren't talking to him, they'd say that you have to listen to Fox because liberals aren't speaking.
Didn't he admit a felony during one of those interviews? I'm not sure that that was a charm offensive.
I mean, the presidential approval polls are still pretty grim. I don't see any evidence that he's charming or winning over the public. But that doesn't mean he can't win re-election.
And finally, from Martina, at least from this round, Martina says this is regarding the photo. You were talking about this yesterday, not this, but you were saying that
photos.
We needed a photo or something that people can cling on to. And then this photo
now there is.
Came out, right, of the horrible photo of the father and his daughter lying dead in the Rio Grande. This is a national disgrace. Please address.
Well, there's no question about that. You know, this one picture really does create an awful lot more than a statistical analysis of what's happening on the border. You see this father lying face down with his daughter cuddled in his arms, also dead. Which parent or grandparent or uncle or aunt can't understand that?
But at the same time, there have been photos of other caskets of other children, and there have been so many narratives of others who have perished from the heat, from malnutrition, and just making these very dangerous journeys just to try to seek asylum. And yet that hasn't changed. Not much has changed since that, you know, what quote-unquote iconic photo in Aleppo happened in Syria, you know, that did, you know, create some attention. But again, these systemic changes still haven't been addressed.
Although the other side of that one is there are these incredible photographs which make a real difference. Vietnam, for those of us who are old enough to remember the little kid with the gun pointed at his head,
there's two separate photos that you're talking about.
The little kid.
There was a little kid who had been napalmed, and then there was.
Oh, yeah.
And then
there wasn't a gun to her head. Though.
Then there was the one of them shooting the prisoner with the gun to that. Yeah. Right.
And the prisoner, for whatever it's worth, looked awfully young to me.
He's short, but he wasn't young.
Yeah, Alan, no,
that's what malnourishment does.
You know, Jen, you sound so learned, and I know you are an academic, but it makes me crazy when we talk about systemic problems, when there are actual people being hurt. We are the systems. I find that really unconvincing.
It's
policy problems. It's systemic change. Oh, lack of resources.
Right, but
this
but
is a solvable
problem. There's a
problem
when someone's hungry. There's a gate
is
between you and you want to give
solution?
Them food and
take
someone's
the diapers,
saying no.
Break the rules. We don't have people who break the rules who don't do.
No,
you know,
we're asking
they,
to.
They
what,
do what they're.
I think we're asking two separate. I think what Jen's saying is. The overall problem is systemic, and I agree with Chris. I'm not sure it's solvable. Now, certainly the problem of we have a million people in facilities that can fit 150,000, mm-hmm. I get that we can solve that. Mm-hmm. You know, if that remains the problem, I believe that we can bring resources to bear and we could do that. But to Jen's point, I think what Jen's point is, solving the whole problem that there's always going to be there's countries that are so bad that people are willing to risk themselves and their children to trek 1,000 miles to get to a better place. I'm not sure there's a full fix for
that. Well, and the other problem is about
the
facilities.
She was arguing that there's no way to help because of systemic problems in bureaucracy.
Well, it's
that's
systemic that
same.
We even have detention facilities that are meant to hold people more than a couple of days. Yeah. And yes, it is a systemic issue because the kids who have been there for more than a week, and that shouldn't happen. That's part of the problem. And even if you don't have enough caseworkers to help them find their families, you don't have enough places to, you know, move them to pipelines into other cities where, whether it's a sanctuary city or another home that wants to, because there's so much bureaucracy, there's not enough people tracking who's who, there's not enough lawyers to represent these people as they go through their asylum cases. That's something we can't all help. I mean, you know, I'm not qualified to handle that legal part. I'm qualified to, yes, buy a bar of soap and you know, a package of toothpaste and help with that, but that's a Band-Aid.
And bring diapers in, and we're prosecuting people on the borders who are trying to help migrants. That's happening in Texas.
And that's a problem.
Now.
That's another problem.
That's
of
not a systemic problem. That's stupidity. That's,
well, that's
really
incompetence.
Fixable tomorrow.
Yeah, it is. Yes. Right.
All right. Let's take a break. Take a chill pill, everybody. We'll be right back after this short break.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Chris Churchill, Rich Honan, and Rosemary Armeo on the panel. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Did anyone want to make a point before we move?
I did. We got a great letter from Chris, who says, Chris and Rich, two voices of reason in the WAMC echo chamber. Sent from my iPhone. Let's everybody remember this letter, because you know what? You can't have it both ways. Either you have people who debate and debate seriously, or you don't. And so Chris, I don't think he meant to make this point, makes it for us.
I'm not such a big fan of that letter.
I like the echo chamber. I like hearing my voice repeated at me over and over and over again.
All right. Let's go to I thought this was so. While we have a few moments before the top of the hour, there was an article in the Washington Post that I thought was interesting because they compared the treatment of the children and the migrants to those in prisons of Taliban. The federal government told the panel of Ninth Circuit appellate judges last week the U.S. border detention facilities are, quote, safe and sanitary as required by law. Senior U.S. Circuit Judge A. Wallace Tashima told the government attorney, if you don't have a toothbrush, if you don't have soap, if you don't have a blanket, it's not safe, it's not sanitary. That argument spread rapidly across the internet, and so did several tweets supporting the notion that the United States treats migrant detainees less humanely than foreign pirates and the Taliban treat their captives. American journalist Michael Scott Moore, abducted in 2012 while reporting in Somalia, watched Fabian argue that minimal necessities like toiletries and sleeping conditions were not essential to meet minimum safe and sanitary standards. That was, let's say, below my experience in Somalia, he told the Washington Post of his more than 2 years in captivity. The conditions were about as miserable as you can imagine, describing a barren and concrete prison house.
Often there was no electricity, but we had certain minimum things that kept it from being completely wretched. He said he was given toothpaste, soap, a daily shower, and a foam mattress.
I guess they fixed the systemic problems.
Well, you're not letting that one go, are you?
what would be the better thing to do?
Get him out of the facility. What do you mean? Faster.
Well, but where would you, where do they go?
What Rosemary's saying is, I think where the progressive wing of America wants it to be, which is maybe you process people in a kind of expedited way, and then you send them out somewhere, out into America.
I
disagree with that, but I think that is the goal of this entire process, and I just don't think that's the right way to go.
I think it's important of the government officials who said, we don't have stuff like soap in these facilities because they're not intended to be held for 27 days as some of them were. They're supposed to be there for a few hours.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to remember, though, that while the child separation policy was cruel and outrageous, it is sometimes cruel just to release children into situations that are unstable, or just to say, here's a big country, go out there and find your way. I mean, there are children who arrive without parents. There are children who arrive in abusive situations, and sometimes those children do have to be held for a little while. I mean, that.
Okay, no one disputes
that. They're not being held.
And they should be held
but
that's humanely. But you're just saying, get them out of those buildings as quickly as possible.
I'm talking about children who are separated from their parents.
But Rosemary, isn't it just as cruel to effectively be inviting people into the country knowing that we don't have the facilities to deal with them? Because effectively, that's what. That is the takeaway from us having people come in and then having them dispersed in this, diaspora, across the United States. And in a way, we're saying our actions are basically saying, come on in, and then people get here and we don't have the facilities to take it. I think that's just as cruel as what you're talking
about. I think that's rhetoric. What we have effectively done is create another barrier to getting here. It doesn't stop them because what they face at home is so horrific.
That's empirically not true.
And we add one more hazard on the way.
But that's empirically not true, that the amount of people trying to get in has increased.
Correct.
So obviously, we're not doing that.
Because things at home are so bad.
That's part of it. And also because they know that there's little controls, little regulation on their ability to get into the country.
All right, let's go to some letters before we go to a break. And
I'd like to just say one thing really quickly, that is, we have created a second-class citizenry in this country. People who are here, have arrived here, and who really, we just solved some of it in New York with driver's licenses, but who would have been marginalized to the point that they're living in fear all the time. Sooner or later, we're going to have to pay the price for that.
I mean, you could ask any person. It goes beyond immigration, too. And once you're here in this country and you look different than someone else, you still have plenty of other social and other barriers to deal with and reckon with in this country. And I am speaking as an Indian naturalized citizen woman, a young person. And reporter. So I'm hated in at least four or five categories. And that's
I feel the
something,
same way about that.
I deal with every day.
But then you bring on, Rich, I can't help responding to that when you say you feel the same way. You bring it on yourself. Now, there are, of course, a lot of people who don't do that, who are of color otherwise, but then you add to that the idea that they're here illegally, Jen. Your point is extremely well taken, but that is one more really substantial layer, yes?
It definitely is a layer, and that's why, again, these things do need to be, even if you get the basic needs met now, you're still going to have to deal with so many other systems. And I'm not just talking about infrastructure, I'm not just talking about legal, but there are so many other issues of poverty, of working,
societal
issues, not to mention the trauma of just coming over a border and then having to deal with that, reckon with that, and while you're trying to just fit in. And, you know, it's a lot. And I think all these things need to be taken into consideration when you're spending billions of dollars, and how are you spending those billions of dollars effectively?
All right. We have a couple more letters, and then we'll go to the top of the hour here. Dale says, what if a group of congressmen and women banded together and went to the doorstep of a detention facility and demanded to be let in with cameras in tow? Also, why are the governors of the states that these facilities are in not stepping in? Every crisis needs a hero. Someone needs to step up and take charge of the situation.
I think the governors are asking for support.
They're all asking. They're asking for help, but these are their federal facilities. I mean,
I also think congressmen have been have done that exact thing.
Well, but people on both sides. People have gone to the border, and people have gone to the facilities. I mean, I don't think anybody has failed to shine a light on the problem.
We got this from Alice, who says, what is the ratio of immigrants going to Jordan fleeing terrible conditions to Jordan's overall population and land area versus the immigrants coming here to the United States and our population and land area, Rosemary? Can't we accommodate most of these immigrants?
Can America or can Jordan has there's more than 1.5 million Syrians in Jordan, which just like totally has reconstituted the population of the country. It's way beyond their capacity. And the only way they're getting it done at all is with massive aid from the United States and Saudi Arabia.
And with the Hashemite guard, right? I mean, in other words, the king has surrounded himself, obviously, with people who can control some of what's going on. You're the expert, and I demand a half an hour of your time at some point to tell us all about this. But it's a very interesting equilibrium.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Rich Honan, Chris Churchill, and Jen Smith. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Keith writes, Rich is obfuscating the facts. The majority of the families who are coming here are doing it legally. Once they are released from custody, over 90% of the families are returning for their asylum hearings. These people want to be legal. They want their families to participate in the American dream, so they show up to all of their hearings. That from Keith.
I'd argue a little with the number, but I know that to be the case, that the great majority of people do, you know, try to show up and do appear at their hearings.
John says, we are hearing about how bad it is in Central America, which is causing the surge in immigration. If it's so bad, why aren't we seeing many news reports from those areas?
I'm sorry, say that again.
We're hearing about how bad it is in Central America. Why aren't we hearing news reports from those areas in Central America?
I thought we were.
Americans don't read foreign news.
Wait a minute. Haven't we been hearing about Venezuela?
Venezuela, but not Guatemala. What do we know about Guatemala? Yeah. I haven't read an article about Guatemala.
It's also really
since
unsafe.
I got back.
Yeah, some of these places are not safe places for reporters just to be wandering around. But I do agree with Rich. There is reporting from those places.
Yes, we no longer rely on Americans and Brits to go in and do our foreign reporting. There are Guatemalan journalists who write. We don't have a. The Times Union has such a big foreign news section, for example.
Well, when's the last time?
Silence.
When's the last time the New York Times, you know, had a big story about what is really going on in, you know, in Guatemala or something like that? You know, that's not front page news every day.
They've done stuff on the gangs. And again, actually, it was Trump who brought that up.
Which is what most people bring up is the gangs, right? Or the cartels.
Well, those are pretty big things to bring up, Rich.
Yeah. Tara writes, as an American, these concentration camps for children are unacceptable to me. What can I do today to get our government to stop this? Should I write a letter to my congressman? Should I organize a protest? I don't want to wait until Trump is voted out in 2020 to solve this problem. Any ideas you have for what to do today would be great. Thanks for all you do.
Sarah
talked about it Monday, right. Write a letter.
I was going to say, you can do all of the above. You can talk to families in your community and ask them if they have family members who need help. You know,
and I would also wouldn't assume that voting Trump out in 2020 is going to solve the problem. I mean, some of these problems, systemic problems, as Jen points out, go back, you know, long before Trump ever came along.
Or I hate to say it, that Trump is going to be voted out in 2020. That's a big assumption.
But I think the letter writer was also just wanting to help families, and I think there are definitely plenty of opportunities. I think most communities have some sort of local immigration center they can reach out to and ask, you know, what the needs are of people.
And I think what the local people would tell you, the people who run, whether it's, you know, the food pantries and church groups and things like that, I think they are, especially along the border, I think they would tell you they are doing you know, everything they possibly can as well.
If you contact any of the border towns where these dissension centers are located, there's a lot of like grassroots boots on the ground. And, you know, plenty of people are driving there to protest to try to get goods and things there. So you can definitely reach out to them and see if anyone's actually having any luck and, you know, divert your resources there.
We got this letter from Denise, who says, good morning. Alan mentioned that we are creating a second-class citizenry in this country. I think that the fact is we have always had a class system in this country, starting with slavery, then Jim Crow, which has continued in one form or another, aided even now by voter suppression and our unfair prison system. The American caste system continues to grow with these newest refugees. Charles says, in a real world, the United States would admit that we created this problem by decades of coups and undermining those with whom we disagree, making their country unlivable. Paul says, if Trump really had compassion for and wanted to change the conditions for those in his concentration camps, why hasn't he used some of the funds that he siphoned off from other agencies for building 400 of his 400 feet of his border wall? Instead, he prefers to send a message that immigrants from the Northern Triangle countries will suffer if they dare come to our southern border, and blame the Democrats for not appropriating funds to alleviate the suffering. And I think that is it. Those two letters are repeats. Okay. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We welcome your letters. Let's go on to other things and talk about other subjects in the 15 minutes or so that we have. We go to the fact, the news that broke yesterday, that Robert Mueller will testify to Congress in open session about his investigation. It is expected next month, and we didn't know if he was going to or not. And now the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees announced late Tuesday that, pursuant to a subpoena, Robert Mueller has agreed to appear before both panels on July 17th. Mueller, who oversaw the 22-month inquiry, is perhaps the one person lawmakers in the nation have been waiting to hear from the most.
Doesn't this, and maybe everybody will disagree for a change, but doesn't this sound like a very small – doesn't this sound like a very small deal compared to what we've just been talking about, like millions of people, you know, living in poverty, trying to escape, and then, you know, coming here and not being able to find, you know, living conditions. I'm getting to the point where I'm kind of over this a lot, no matter which way it goes. And I just feel like on the spectrum of important things in our world, I just don't think this
sort
falls.
Of the president of the United States committing felonies feels like an important thing.
And had that happened, that would have been important to me as well.
And that's the question that brings it to Congress, did he or not? What I find fascinating is that Mueller's desire that his report be enough is not enough. That we have to somehow read it, reenact it in podcasts where actors are reading parts of it. That this somehow has more impact. And yet I know it does. I've seen it. When he appears in Congress saying the same thing he wrote, it somehow has a different impact. And it all goes to the fact that Mueller can't do the job. He threw it to Congress. That's where it belongs. You impeach the guy, or you don't impeach him, or you investigate him, or you take it on. But stop. Leave Mueller alone. That part I'm sick of, too.
Well, I think Mueller's full of crap. I think if Mueller wanted his report to be the last word, he would have written a report that said what exactly what he thought. He wouldn't have written that whole last 100 pages that said, oh, there's issues of fact and law that make it, without telling us what those issues of fact and law were. And that when he said those issues of fact and law that make it difficult for us to, or make it impossible for us to reach a conclusion on this, if he wanted his report to stand on its own, he should have said, here's what we think. Here's the facts that we think could be taken as obstruction. Here's the law that we think could be taken as obstruction. We don't come down on it because we think we're not allowed to do it, or whatever.
I don't disagree with you on that, but why do you, as a lawyer, why do you think he didn't?
I think I don't. As a lawyer, I don't know. As from a political standpoint, and I don't want to. I'm not going to recite all the Fox News talking points, but it sure seemed like after the first 100 pages of the report that basically said there's no collusion, conspiracy, whatever the legal term is. They then spent a lot of time saying, you know, there's a lot of things that could be obstruction, but we're not going to tell you what they are. I think part of that was political, that coming from not so much Mueller, but from the folks he had working for him.
I think that's very weak. I think, Mueller is walking the sharp side of the razor blade here. He knew he could get fired, and we knew that Trump, from his own words and from the words of others, tried to fire him. So he was trying to make sure that he could stay. I think that this is I think it's clear that this could be everything if he wants to tell everything he knows, or it could be nothing, as you suggest, Rich. But your position about the nothing side of it is very Trumpian, if I do say so.
Well, go ahead, Rich.
No. Go.
Well, I agree with Rich and Joe that he should have come to a conclusion. Mueller is temperamentally cautious.
And get fired?
He wouldn't have been. But at that point, the report would have already been out. Well, who cares at that point? He could have said whatever he wanted to say in the report.
Right.
That doesn't.
Yes, except
and if
that
he got fired at that point or became, the enemy of the president, well, that's kind of what I thought he was hired to do. Mm-hmm. To spend all that money and all that time and then not come to a conclusion is kind of shirking your duty.
And to tell us apparently, under his thinking, he never could have come to a conclusion on that issue. That's something I would have liked to have known earlier on. He could have said that without compromising anything by saying, just so everybody's clear, I'm going to look at this, but if people are looking for us to recommend an indictment against the president, I cannot do that by my reading of the regulations. That's something that would have been good to know.
He
didn't say that right away. He said that after the whole thing was done.
He said that. He said he couldn't, and he couldn't because of the constraints that he was under.
When did he say that, Alan?
Well, if you would like the date and the time, I'm afraid I can't give it to you, but
I agree with Rich on this. I think I never understood why he got such kudos for being silent and keeping a tight ship, and that did not help people understand what he was doing and how he was going about doing it. And
it was good to be silent and keep a tight ship before the report was released.
He could have done that going in saying, look,
he could have told
no matter
us
what
the
comes
scope.
Out of this,
right.
I haven't made up my mind, but no matter what comes out of it, it isn't.
He could have also been silent and stoic and all the wonderful things people are attributing to him, and also said made a recommendation one way or the other, or said what he thought. To me, he dodged his responsibility.
I don't know. I think he's a strict constitutionalist in the way that conservative judges are not, they're really activists. And he read the Constitution saying it's Congress that decides that. And in Watergate, it was Congress who decided. It wasn't the special counsel who said we have to find him guilty. Why do they need more evidence and all that? They have the right to do it. And they're afraid to do it for political inconvenience or whatever. This is on Pelosi.
So what does anyone have to gain from this hearing and knowing that he's going to likely stick to his guns in the report?
I think we're a very visual culture, and I think that people seeing him say the words that are in the report could potentially have an impact. But I also agree that he's such a cautious guy and such a careful guy that I wouldn't expect him to say anything besides, in some ways, the blandest of language.
But what kind of relevant impact could it have in such a brief time, relatively speaking, before the elections?
Well, it would only be from a political standpoint, I don't know. From a standpoint of what would I like, if you said, Rich, you have 5 minutes to question Mueller, how would you use it? I would say, can you tell us the facts and the law that you were referring to when you said, because of the difficult facts and law, you can't make a recommendation on this particular issue of obstruction, for example. And the first question I would ask is, so are you telling us that the only reason you didn't recommend anything against the president was because of the Justice Department guidelines? Was that the only reason? And if he says, and then I would say, what are you saying, for example, was the firing of Comey arguably obstruction? Is that what we're talking about? Is that, this issue of law or something? Because at least then I have something to discuss and think about. That's what I would ask him, but he's not going to answer any of that. I agree with you.
But even if he did answer that, what could that outcome be? Would that shift your thinking or anyone's thinking? Do you think it could actually make any policy difference? Would it change the way we're addressing Russia, for example, or looking at scrutinizing, you know, meetings of this administration?
Well, it just depends on what he says. I mean, there's a possibility he could come out so forcefully that it could lead to impeachment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible. I'm not saying that's likely, but without knowing what he's going to say, it's hard to know what the ramifications will be.
But then if he does say something forceful, a person on the political person on the other side of that is going to say, then why wasn't that in your report? Exactly. And why wasn't that subsumed in your recommendation? I think this is going to be an Adam Schiff kind of, mm-hmm. Media event, don't you think?
I agree.
All right, let us talk about one other thing here before in our final moments together, and that is a little bit of a preview of what's happening tonight. The big debate, the mega debate, is happening. It's a two-night affair, don't you know? And it is going to be happening both tonight and tomorrow night. And we are going to see... Well, I don't know what we're going to see. What do you think we're going to see?
I'm still stuck on the phrase two-night affair. But is Trump still going to live tweet? He said he was going to live tweet during the debates. Is that still going to happen?
I wasn't aware that he had made that announcement.
Only one man knows if that's still going to happen.
You know, they have two.
You guys are the experts. Are you looking forward? What are you looking forward to seeing?
Well, hold on.
I'm telling you. The participants have a choice. They can attack each other and form the circular firing squad, or they can attack the president. And how desperate they are to be president and to get that nomination is going to depend on what their attitude is.
Well, tonight, at least, Biden won't be on the stage, so they won't have him to go after. Presumably,
yes, they will.
Well,
yes, they will.
That's true. But he won't be there to defend himself, I suppose. But
Bill de Blasio, Tim Ryan, Julian Castro, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, Tulsi Gabbard, Jay Inslee, and John Delaney making up tonight's undercard.
The one question I have, and I don't know if anyone else in this room is slightly concerned about this, is also the number of moderators that are
three moderators over 2 hours
offered, and you know, whether from different channels, and I wonder how that will potentially skew.
Well, I think a lot of these candidates are going to be looking to have their breakout moment. You know, mm-hmm. the moment that, like, how many people will actually watch these 2 hours is probably relatively small. But if you can get that little clip that goes viral and kind of, if for a Kirsten Gillibrand, say, somebody who's kind of really struggling to take off, if you can get something that really makes you stand out, I think that's what they'll all be aiming for, mm-hmm. Which means it probably won't really be very substantive. It'll mm-hmm. probably be kind of...
Yeah. It'd be a lot better if we could all phone in, like with, America's Got Talent. Say, I vote for Kristen. Yeah.
Well, the person who's going to have the made for TV moment has got to be Cory Booker.
Absolutely.
Right? Booker is, if you were betting, right, you could take the field. I'll take Cory Booker, and
well,
I'm going to
win
that
bet.
What
will he do in order to break out? He'll have to attack either Biden or other Democrats.
I think that's what he's going to do. I think he's going to take on Biden. Maybe he'll start with this whole Strom Thurmond thing or something. But I think I could be, this is way out of my league. But I think
structure to the debate
too,
because they won't be able to make opening remarks, correct? And so it'll really be up to whatever the questions that the moderators throw at them, how they choose to respond, and what they say in their final. How many seconds do they have? Is it 30 seconds?
Can we agree,
though,
that it's a silly format and kind of a dumb format?
Yes. I mean,
they each get 60 cents. That for someone like Elizabeth Warren, who has very detailed policy proposals,
you can't detail that.
She's at a complete even though she's done so much more than all these other candidates to kind of put forth ideas, whether you find them compelling or not, she's done much more than the others have. She can't explain those things in 60 seconds. Nobody can.
Well,
is coming up fast.
Yeah, but they should have done it like the NCAAs, where it's just like a series of like everybody one-on-one debates, and then whoever wins that debate, and then you make your way up to the brackets, and like Biden gets a bye in the first round or something like that.
I mean, that is sort of how traditional debate works.
That's how it should work.
America's Got Talent. I'm telling you, that's the way.
What Lincoln Douglas was what, an hour, and
this
then an hour
be,
and a half
this
to
will
respond.
Not be Lincoln this Douglas. Won't be. That much for now.
You know what? One day, read some of the the contemporaneous newspaper accounts of those debates, and right, Rosemary, that is as partisan and as skewed as anything we see right now.
That's true.
But I want to go back to the Booker comment from Rich. That's interesting because Booker has gone back and forth between two positions. One is I'm an angry man, justifiably so, and I want to make that anger plain. And the other is people think I'm angry, and that doesn't help me. I want to be more Obama-like, so I'm going to be much more cautious in what I say. It'll be interesting to see what he does.
He can't be cautious. He's got to come out angry. I think we're going to see angry Corey.
Well, he's charismatic, and that'll help him in a debate like this. But he's also pretty substance-free for the most part, so that may also help him.
He's unrestrained by substance.
Well, on those very helpful notes, we'll end the proceedings for this morning. My thanks to everybody, Jen Smith, Chris Churchill, Richard. Man, you're all like leaving right away, aren't you? Just give me a second. Let me say goodbye first. Rich, just stay in your seat.
Stop dancing.
Get all the cats. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Jen and Chris, Rich, Rosemary, thank you all very much. Alan, thank you. We'll be back after this.